How much of the Buddha, how much of the Dharma, how much of the Sangha? Good morning. So there's a couple different teachings that I want to touch on here and explore a little above how they relate to each other. And the underlying question is, something along the lines of, what are we doing here? Like, that's what's motivating it. What's my motivation? Why are we practicing? Or imagining that practicing would be a nice thing to do if I could get myself to do it. So I think that those, some versions of those questions are, fairly universal. Even if they aren't things that are keeping you up at night, they show up. They're probably more the kind of question that shows up when you want to do one thing and also have the sense that something else would be better in the big scheme of things. Does that ever happen? Okay, good, good. Just making sure I'm in the right place. Okay. So, the eight realizations of a great being it's the last fascicle that Dogen worked on before he died. So Dogen's like a 13th century monk in our lineage who, probably the most famous Zen person in Japan, from Japan. The fascicle is unusual in that about 90% of it is a long quote. And the quote is taken from the very last teaching that the Buddha gave. So these aren't the Buddha's last words, but they're his last actual sermon. So it's a pretty striking parallel there between Dogen and the Buddha in terms of this being the final teaching. The Japanese title is Ache Dainin Gaku. The Gaku is the same as in my name, Gaku meaning realization or awakening to, remembering, or just truth. Dainin, I think, is the same as Dainin. And I don't think we have anybody in the Sangha named Eight, so Ache is not represented here. Translating it as eight realizations or eight truths makes it kind of sound something static, right? Like there's something gained by that. And I kind of prefer eight remembrances, which makes it sound a little more ongoing, a little more continuous. So these are eight remembrances, eight practices that are shared by all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they pair naturally into four sets. Buddhas have small desires and no satisfaction. They enjoy a simple, tranquil life and practice with steady diligence. They are mindful and concentrated. They are wise, and they do not engage in idle discussion. So there's lots of lists in Buddhism and lots of overlap between the lists in Buddhism. And so I'm sure you can draw some of those lines of overlap here. I want to focus on the first pair, which are ones that are not as frequently overlapped in other lists. Having small desires and knowing satisfaction. These are two sides of the same coin. Right? They're kind of positive and negative formulations of non-attachment. So having small desires is not getting caught by the mind of acquisitiveness and preference, right? Not being heavily influenced by that unwholesome energy of craving. And then knowing satisfaction is readily accessing the positive states of gratitude, appreciation, ease, delight. So I get that these are not super sexy, right? These are not the two most like high-profile members of the eight remembrances. It's one thing to remember to be wise, like to remember non-duality, moment by moment, to be able to meet much of life from that state. You know, we just chanted Maha, Prajna, Paramita several times. You know, we chant that at the end of each service. That's the perfection of wisdom, great wisdom. So that's an easier sell. Like, sure, like, it's obvious that I'd like to remember that, right? I'd like to be that kind of Buddha that has plenty of wisdom, plenty of prajna. But when there's this, like, nagging sense, oh, it's you. Like, yes, like, it's different, right? Like, this is, like, small desires is not as fun. It's not as fun as prajna. But that's why I'm doing this Dharma talk, because that perspective is pretty out of touch with reality. And I don't want to steal too much from this Wednesday's class. Sokuchi's not here, so she doesn't know. But we are suffering. And it's happening, and these first two remembrances are incredibly effective at mitigating that fact. So I want to read two quotes from Dogen, from this fascicle. So basically it's quoting the Buddha as well, two for one. This is the Nishijima Cross translation. These two sections are the pieces which actually name-check suffering. So the small desire. And the Buddha said, "You bhikshus should know that people of abundant desire abundantly seek gain, and so their suffering also is abundant. People of small desire, being free from seeking and free of desire, are free of this affliction. You should practice and learn small desire just for itself. Still more, small desire can give rise to all virtues. People of small desire never curry favor and bend in order to gain the minds of others. Further, they are not led by the sense organs. Those who practice small desire are level in mind. They are without worries and fears. When they come into contact with things that they have latitude, and they are constantly free from dissatisfaction. Those who have small desire just have nirvana. This is called small desire." So Buddha starts out kind of late, right? You should desire and learn small desire just for itself. And then he really kind of lays it on by the end. Those who have small desires just have nirvana. So it's important. And the second one, to know satisfaction. The Buddha said, "If you bhikshus desire to get rid of all kinds of suffering, you should reflect on knowing satisfaction. The practice of knowing satisfaction is the very place of abundance, joy, and peace. People who know satisfaction, even when lying on the ground, are still comfortable and joyful. Those who do not know satisfaction, even when living in a heavenly palace, are still not suited. Those who do not know satisfaction, even if rich, are poor. People who know satisfaction, even if poor, are rich. Those who do not know satisfaction are constantly led by the five desires. They are pitied by those who know satisfaction. This is called to know satisfaction." So this knowing satisfaction kind of cuts in line, right? There's suffering, and there's all these other fancier remembrances that are going to help deal with it. And knowing satisfaction just kind of steps up and says, like, I'm happy. And poof, suffering is gone, right? The other remembrances are kind of left looking around, wondering why they didn't get the help. Of course, they did get the help, but knowing satisfaction is pretty, it's pretty key. So I'm going to come back to these. There's more on these two, but I want to first turn to transition to looking at a parallel list. So the paramitas, or perfections, are another list of qualities possessed by great beings. And paramitas are an older teaching that kind of evolved for 1,000 years or so. And so a lot of different versions out there. They're most frequently encountered in lists of either 6 or 10. And there's both Mahayana and Theravada versions of both. The first 6 are typically generosity, ethics, patience, vigor, concentration, and prajna. Pretty solid amount of overlap with the 8 realizations. 4 are basically the same. The paramita of generosity kind of overlaps this first 2 that I was talking about, the few desires and knowing satisfaction. The list of the 10 Mahayana paramitas adds 4 additional qualities: skillful means, upaya, vow, spiritual power or bala, and knowledge. So I want to focus on dana, which kind of absorbs the first 2 of the 8 realizations, and bala, spiritual power. So dana, generosity, is like the is renunciation, basically. It's letting go, both in the sense of like generosity of offering, but also in the sense of giving up, of relinquishment. It's very closely tied in with gratitude, and that, you know, gratitude nourishes dana, dana nourishes gratitude. They fold together. It's the first paramita because it's about this remembering where we are, right? Of practicing the ability of the mind, of bringing the mind of letting go to whatever the activity at hand is. It shows the degree to which we can give up self-centeredness, right? Give up self-centeredness as kind of the foundation of our interactions, both in the human realms in terms of relationships and in terms of, you know, meeting the activities of life, the conditions that we find ourselves in. So often there's suffering and there's resistance to what our conditions are. And so letting go of that is hard, right? This is a fairly, it can be kind of a fierce paramita, right? It's intimate, it's engaged. It's hard not to be able to give all that we see is needed. It's hard to feel gratitude for this life and this practice and not be able to express it adequately. Right? There's like this paramita gets into tender places real quick. And the relation to the first 2 remembrances is that an acquisitive mind trends towards dukkha, right? A non-accumulative mind leads to sukha, to the opposite of dukkha, to peace, right? When we're not trying to hold on, trying to get, trying to keep away, it's nice, and we feel gratitude, which creates this wholesome circuit. And that's one of the reasons why gratitude is such a foundational expression of realization. As we get better at this, gratitude just happens. So that's kind of a intro to dana. Bala, spiritual power, is a little trickier. You'll find wildly, wildly different interpretations of what this is or means. And part of that is because like it's been approached over time in really different ways, in different cultures, by different teachers and traditions within the Mahayana. Some say it refers to the 5 powers, which is another list which kind of overlaps the paramitas. It's got faith and zeal and stuff in it. Mindfulness is in there. Or to the Siddhis, which are more like kind of vaguely supernatural powers that come as a, you know, product of concentration, really deep concentration. Chico did a talk on that in somewhat recent memory. Others relate to manifesting the Dharma. So here's a passage from the Avatamsaka, Mahayana Sutra. And it's given an example of what bala is used for. Suppose there were an inexpressibly countless number. You can tell already this is the Avatamsaka, right? Name that sutra in one line. Suppose there were an inexpressibly countless number of living beings, each with different kinds of karma and retribution. Suppose that they all assembled together in a single place with a bodhisattva in their midst. And suppose that this assembly was broad and vast, filling countless worlds, and that each assembly had an inexpressibly countless number of mouths able to raise a sound of countless hundreds of thousands of millions of voices, with each and all of them asking different questions simultaneously. These bodhisattvas would be able to answer all their questions and resolve all their doubts in a single instant. So that's a pretty impressive display of bala. I get my questions one at a time, and I get multiple instances to answer them, and I suspect all of the doubts are fairly rarely resolved, and you're all okay with that. So my bala is a work in progress. I'm lucky that you know a certain amount of satisfaction. That's great. Dogen says about bala that it is drinking tea and eating rice. Layman Peng said it's chopping wood and carrying water. Those are kind of classic Zen takes, which I agree with, but need a little explanation maybe. I would say that bala is how we recognize a successful practice. Right? There's something about a dedicated practitioner that is recognizable across traditions. Right? It may be visible in how they drink tea or chop wood, but it obviously doesn't depend on the drinking tea or the chopping of wood. There's lots of different ways that it could manifest, but broadly, when someone's really devoted themselves to religious practice, their life is closely, clearly aligned with their sense of purpose, right? There's a sense of ease and settledness with that. There's a depth of meaning and presence that's available. And these qualities give them a specific kind of leverage, which is what the Avatamsaka is trying to illustrate with that story. A certain kind of credibility there. So we're talking about a kind of attainment, something that changes over time as we practice. Do you feel nervous? As modern, you know, largely convert Zen practitioners in America, we have a tendency to want that attainment, right? Which is, of course, a catch-22, because it tends to trip over the few desires and knowing satisfaction part of the equation. So our cultural fabric is such that we probably see spiritual power as something that we want for ourselves, right? We're kind of, there's a sort of Protestant congregationalist fabric to things. So that assumption doesn't exist in the same way in Japan, where a more standard perspective is that one would want spiritual power used on one's behalf, right? Dedicating merit is a really core practice of using spiritual power on someone else's behalf. It's a pretty obvious mode of interaction with the sacred for many in Japan. There was a presentation yesterday as part of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. There was a conference. That's where Genko and Joshin are right now. That argued that we are collectively overvaluing meditation and undervaluing lifestyle and ethical aspects of Zen in our practice. And that's something that I broadly agree with. It's something that I fought with the Carlsons, about for many years. And basically what was going on there is that, like, I had big desires. Like, they were, you know, largely congregated in the spiritual dimension. And so I thought, like, that's okay. In fact, I was highly identified with them. And I wanted bala. I wanted prajna. And I was fascinated with attainment and felt that rigorous formal meditation seemed like the way to get more of it. And Gyogen and Gyoko were not fascinated, which is really useful for me. And so I was lucky in that I had good teachers and auspicious conditions and was able to absorb some of these foundational practices, even though I was less interested in them, like few desires. And over time, I saw how fragile that edifice was, right? That how alienating it can be for many. I think Zen is a really incredible practice. And I think it's broad, it's deep, it has so much to offer to many people. And there's also many people who are never going to have a regular meditation practice, right? So teachings like few desires, like generosity, like knowing satisfaction, are relevant in all times, right? In all places. You know, for myself, I thrive in a formal container. I've spent about 3 years of life on Sesshin, right? But it doesn't depend on that. And you certainly don't have to share this particular set of causes and conditions to be transformed by this practice. Incidentally, the person who gave that presentation yesterday, Byakuren, is someone I've known for a long time, and she's going to be doing a little workshop here this fall, sometime in October, in a Dharma talk, pairing with that. So if you want to, you'll get a chance to meet her. So back to why we're here. Is it for getting out of suffering? Is it for collecting attainment? Is it for being useful, right? One of the teachings around Dana is that there's three levels of offering. There's the first level is giving what we value, right? The second level is giving what someone else values. And the third is giving what's prajna values, what's truly needed. There's lots of different ways of divvying up these. But I think that applies here. So having small desires, knowing satisfaction in an easy way, like in a reliable way, should not be overlooked. Renunciation and gratitude and generosity should not be overlooked. It may not be what brought you here, and it may not be what you're hoping for from practice, but it's what we need, right? This is what prajna wants for us. And under committing to these practices, to these remembrances, by prioritizing the glitzier members of the list, like mindfulness, concentration, and prajna, maha prajna paramita, is a little arrogant, right? So Sekito Kisen, who we chanted his name today, he doesn't get a clap, but probably should, has a poem called Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. And it's kind of a celebration of some of the less celebrated remembrances. So I want to read a couple of passages here. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. Satisfaction. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. Few desires. A shining window below the green pines. Jade palaces and vermilion flowers can't compare with it. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk, innocent. So we all have this core need to touch reverence, right? It all matters. It's all our responsibility. We all have this vital need to feel the wonder that comes from knowing that, from tapping into the knowing that there is more. So much more. And that more as an experience, not just a belief. So it can be found by eating rice and drinking tea, chopping wood, carrying water, mowing the lawn, doing your taxes, whatever, all included. If these activities are perfused by meaning, by presence, by awareness, if we are doing that work of letting go of renunciation of the self there. Everything we do can be leveraged by Bala. That leverage comes from not wanting it to be any different from how it actually is. From completely meeting that moment, that activity right here. So I'm going to read the last verses from Sekito's poem to end. Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be familiar with their instruction. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriads of interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. Questions or comments?
We have questions and comments. If you're in the Zendo, raise your hand and I'll bring the mic to you. If you're on Zoom, type your question or comment in the chat box and it'll be read aloud, or you can type your name and you'll be unmuted. And we have one in the Zendo. Please also say your name in the Zendo.
I'm Goshen. Well, there's a lot there. I think the part that I'm tangled up on, inquisitive mind, just dukkha, there's suffering with the inquisitive mind. But so much of our practice, we also need our inquisitive mind.
Acquisitive. Versus inquisitive. Okay. I'm in favor of inquisitive.
Okay.
Acquisitive.
Now I'm okay. So. You answered everything then. I understand everything now. That's great. Thank you.
Ta-da! Take that, Avatamsaka.
I just misheard a word.
I'm Sam. Can you talk a little bit about practices to develop knowing satisfaction?
Oh, yeah, great. So, we often skip past it. So, the problem is that we're often moving at a pace by which we just kind of skip over the satisfaction, moments. And so, and also, it's vulnerable to feel, right? It's kind of scary for people to sort of rest and this is okay right now. Everything's met. Everything's okay. That's like painting a giant target. And so, we have to kind of build up some endurance for that. And so learn to catch the specific things that you do that allow yourself to get past that moment of feeling satisfaction. So you just ate breakfast and your mind goes to, oh, now I have to do the dishes. And in between there, there's a moment somewhere. There's a physical like sensation of like, ah, I mean, I don't know if you eat breakfast or not, but you know, for if you eat breakfast, then there's that moment, right? Somewhere in there, you can find it. And so if you habitually miss it, like go looking. There's lots of those. There's lots of those throughout the day. And like allow yourself to harvest that particular kind of nourishment because it feels good. Like, this is a beautiful floor. Like let it in for a moment. Like just take, you know, 4 seconds right now. Right? Like that's enough to like nudge it a little bit. And it's just the frequency of those sorts of adjustments, those sorts of reminders. It doesn't have to be like anything dramatic. It's more like a regularity of like reorienting and allowing and noticing like, well, what's it like to actually let that in?
Thank you.
This is Suho. I think one of my hang-ups is when I think about those paramitas, like vigor and zeal. And I would generally want to point that kind of energy at things that I want. And so how do I practice with vigor and zeal and still be non-attached and not and be satisfied?
Are you asking how do you point that vigor and zeal towards like
small desires?
Practicing like small desires? Yeah. Well, I think part of it is that there's beliefs we have which get in the way. And so you're exposing yourself to teachings that hopefully chip away at some of those beliefs. And I don't know if it'll help, but you know, I think part of it is like, is catching, you know, catching that, like when you can see that, that bit of storyline, that bit of narrative, that bit of like protecting that goes on, that kind of diverts zeal from going in those ways, recognizing that as extra and that like, I don't have to do that. It's okay. Like that's a valid part of practice. And my guess is if you find, you know, one of those little diversions, one of those adjustments that you make that keep your zeal flowing in areas where it's comfortable for you, like when you find it, you're not going to want to find it, right? There's going to be like, it's going to be, there's part of who you are that's kind of wrapped into that. And so there's some disentangling there. So like we just have to kind of keep pulling at that string, you know, and at some point, like there's enough clarity that like, oh, it's just a string. It's no longer a sweater.
We have one on Zoom. This is from Renzo.
Okay, Renzo.
She says, thank you for your talk. It feels extremely relevant to me right now. Could you please repeat the fascicle name?
Could we please repeat what?
The name of the fascicle.
Oh, yes. 8 Realizations of a Great Being. It's
I
the last.
Maybe the Japanese name, perhaps.
Oh, Achi Dainen Gaku.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Sasha. There was a point in your talk where you brought up how you've got to do something because it feels better to do it.
Mm.
This morning I woke up late and I was like, I'm just not going to go. I'm not going to do it. Well, I'm here.
Ta-da!
And then also I realize a lot of my practice lately has been avoiding expectations. I've always had this mindset of like, what's next, or like, what is going to happen if this happens? And so it's like creating these scenarios of like, okay, this is going to be awful, or like, oh, this is going to be amazing, and then getting disappointed and not feeling that satisfaction with it. Mm-hmm. And I've realized that the more I go into things without expectations, the more satisfied I've been with the experiences. It's kind of weird how that works.
I noticed that also. Yeah, it's reliably true, and it's still hard to do. Yeah.
That's it. Thank you.
Hi, this is Sage. I had a question a few people ago, and it's gone now, but I spend a lot of time with the paramitas, and I think it's interesting how you can't really tug on one without the others being pulled along, it feels like. And the satisfaction piece, I feel it's the one that I come back to most when I'm like struggling with any of the other ones. It's like, okay, let's find like a small thing that I'm enjoying, like, or like, things are actually pretty cool, I'm sure, if I just like look around. But some of them, gosh, I really want to get back to my question, and I just don't have it. Like, it's something like the satisfaction piece, the thread for that is harder to find when I'm like really working with some of the other ones, or when I'm really like wrapped up in, I don't know, some of the bigger ones, I guess. I don't know. It's gone. I'm sorry.
Well, I could try to answer that, but I feel a little like I'm throwing darts. And so let me, like, you know where I live. If it reappears and coalesces into a question, let me know.
Yeah, don't worry. Thank you.
We have another on Zoom. This is a question from Lee. She says, thank you, Kakumyo. I heard you mention that in Japan, it would be obvious to want spiritual power to be utilized on our behalf. I also heard that all of us have a core need to touch, reverence. Could you say more about how we might leverage any degree of bala we might have towards facilitating others' capacity to touch that reverence, wonder, experience of the here and now, of vitality?
Yeah. Nice question. I think what I really trust there is that it's recognized. You know, like that's the, like that's, you know, I said something along the lines of like the, like bala is recognizing the effect of practice. And when you can see that someone is touched by it, it's really motivating. It's really inspiring. Like anybody who's like been on Sesshin, like it's hard, and there's this room full of people who are doing this really hard thing, and like it's so supportive. That's a manifestation of bala. And I think this, like being able to be at ease with your experience of what's sacred is really helpful for others. It's making space for that in the interaction, in the shared environment. And I think we can get really tight around like, well, what skillful means? Like, how do I do this best? Like, which is, it's, you know, that kind of tightness is sort of a, that's acquisitiveness. That's a miss. And really just kind of letting go into, well, how is it? And if we're, if we can do that effectively, like, it's beautiful. and that conveys. Take that as a yes.
My name is Mikio, and I really resonated when you said like being satisfied easily is like, you know, put your big target mark on yourself. And just remembered, like, growing up, like, I could be fairly easily satisfied, and somehow there's a lot of criticism about that. And now I realize that I internalize those, that now I feel like when I'm easily satisfied, like, why are you satisfied? And, you know, why don't you try to do more? Mm-hmm. And I also see, you know, I look at, like, YouTubes and stuff, and many of them had this message of, oh, don't be satisfied. No, you can go more. You can do more. And so what would be...
There's a strong cultural message that our self-worth is kind of dependent on not being satisfied.
Right, yes. Yeah. So what we can do is to just be, like, conscious of that and just say, ooh, that really may not be true. And something like that, just to resist. Because it's everywhere. So.
Yeah, I mean, billboards. Like, yeah, it's everywhere. And I think it's catching it and kind of pulling on Suho's sweater string there and seeing if you can, like, believe it a little less here and there.
Yeah. And it's also, like, confusing in terms of how do you kind of differentiate between that kind of, you know, big desire to do this and that, and what you said about bala, you said. Mm-hmm. It's, to me, it's still a little confusing because I can mistake, you know, like, big desire, like, why don't you do more? Like, oh, this is bala. So how can you say a little more about how you kind of navigate between those different things?
Between bala and...
And like effort based on big desire.
Hmm. Effort based on
big desire.
Big desire.
Or are they the same? No.
Well, maybe I'm not clear about when you're saying big desire, what does that mean for you?
It's more like, I mean, I'm thinking about the simple thing.
Are you talking
thing,
about, like, way-seeking mind, or are you talking about, like, well, like the opposite of small desire?
Like a big desire to be, you know, the number one tennis player in the world.
Okay. Not the latter. Okay. Well, I think it's the same process. I mean, it's the same thing. It's letting go. You know, catching, like, where... I start to identify where I start to tighten up around something and releasing that particular tension in that particular moment. So it may be like, why aren't I the best tennis player? Or it may be like, oh, I have to do this a certain way or whatever. It's all like coalescing around some concretized sense of, like, who I think I should be or am or could be or shouldn't be. And nothing's that static. And so I want to see past that. I mean, that's an aspect of my experience, but there's so much more. And if I'm fixating on that, which is what we do, which is how, you know, thought works, then I'm missing everything else. And so I want to, like, broaden that perspective. And that involves a letting go of that particular thought.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the last one.
I have one.
The privileges of holding the mic.
I think I'm noticing a question regarding wanting to be generous of, like, in spirit, in Sangha with others, but perhaps not having done enough of the, like, knowing satisfaction to maybe really be able to give that. And it kind of becomes this knot in my experience of, like, oh, I really want to, like, be generous here.
Yeah. It's not an either or, right? It's not a strict kind of sequential situation. It's like layers of an onion. So you just, like, yeah, you notice that particular interaction, like, I did not have the satisfaction necessary to really offer what was needed. Great. So you learned something there. And like the next time around, because things keep happening, maybe you'll have a little more. And it's like, you don't have to wait to have one of these, to have, like, the, you know, generosity ticked off your list before you move on to ethics, right? And you don't have to have ethics ticked off your list before you move on to patience. Like, it's all happening together. It's all the same, like, flow of experience.
Is it big desire to, like, really want to be generous in that way? Like, is that actually... is the intensity of that desire wholesome or unwholesome? Is that...
I think you need to check. And I think both answers are true. I think there are times in which, like, you really want that, and you can check it, and you'll find that, oh yeah, there is a lot of me here. And there are other times where it's like, it's being pulled through you, and it's really, it's a whole different feeling. And that feels reverent. Right? One feels kind of tight and the other feels vast. You know, the first one is kind of like, there's a now-ness to it, there's like an urgency to it, there's a what-if-ness to it, there's anxiety, there's storyline. And the second one doesn't have those qualities. But there's still that kind of, like, the hook is set deep, right? Like, we feel that pulling, and it is a big desire, but it's more of a vast desire than a big one.
Thank you.